Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, Dr. Alan Saxon writes the book Training in Charity. Seth Panich writes the book Antique. We talk about the book The West Facade by Lauren Johnson. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we also talk about the book The Secret History of French Cooking.
It's loosely based on the author's own medical school experience. Training in Charity captures what it meant to begin a life in medicine before computers and technology softened the edges, a time when skill was learned by doing and compassion was earned at the bedside. Let's talk about your latest work in novel form, discussing maybe some medical education in America today. I bring you on Dr. Alan Saxon. Good morning to you, Dr. Saxon.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on your program.
When did you know you wanted to be a doctor?
I think I realized that in childhood. My uncle was an old school family practitioner in a neighboring community, and he was quite a dramatic role model for me.
Need those role models. Thank you for that. Of course, continuing to teach at two medical schools, wonderful Northwestern, Rosalind Franklin University in the beautiful Chicago area, and so you serving as a role model. But yet, growing up in different times, that's somewhat, I'm sure, part of the theme of your novel, Training in Charity. Let's start with, first of all, when you know it's time to write a novel with what you know, Dr. Saxon.
Well, I've always been a storyteller. In fact, my family reminds me that I am a repetitious storyteller at dinner time. But I've carried these stories about different patients and the experience with me for more than 50 years. And I realized in the context of what I had experienced, how transformative medical education is in terms of the fact that you learn skills that can really benefit our society as a whole, as well as the individual patients that you take care of.
Just give me an example of a skill.
Well, in my book, not to give too many spoilers, there was a simple skill that medical students did, starting intravenous lines. Nowadays, if you go into a hospital, there are usually specially designated nurses who do that and are really outstanding at it. But back in the 1970s, in medical school, students were responsible for that, and I have an episode in my book where the student who has been gaining confidence in his ability suddenly is faced with a drug addict who has used up all his veins, and he can't start the IV. So I won't give the spoiler as to how he resolves that. But that's a very simple example of the type of skill that I was talking about.
Yes, Training in Charity is the name of your book. What's a little bit more of the storyline in general?
Well, the title itself has a double meaning. Number one, the medical school that I attended used the legendary Charity Hospital in New Orleans for training. Charity was the second oldest public hospital in the country following the founding of Bellevue in New York by about a month. And so it was founded in 1736. And it was what we would now call a safety net hospital, or a hospital that provided services primarily for the indigent, although Charity actually assumed a bigger role than that in the New Orleans area. And the second meaning, of course, is the word charity, which is one of the cardinal values in the practice of medicine. And so I liked having a title that had sort of the double meaning.
Tell us a little more of the story of your characters.
Well, my central character is a third-year student named Adam Sinclair, who is beginning his first clinical rotation. He's making the transition along with two of his classmates from the first 2 years of medical school, which are primarily classroom work and some laboratory work. And he's being placed on the wards at Charity, where he cares for real people. And he becomes involved with the trainees at various levels of residency on Surgical Service One. And he's kind of thrown into this, which is a lot different from academic work, where you know your assignment, you sit and read and study and prepare for an exam. This is a little different because suddenly you're in an environment where you never really know what's coming at you.
Other themes you'd like to share?
Yes, I'd like to point out how transformative the experience of actually getting involved with actual patients is for medical students. And the other theme that underlies the book is, particularly since a lot of medical education now relies on simulated situations, which are sometimes scripted, either using simulated patients or mannequins. And that, I think, in particularly with mannequins, may lack some of the understanding of the empathy and compassion that's necessary for a good physician. Obviously, you want to be very objective and thoughtful about your diagnoses, your patient management, but basically, you want to be able to relate to your patients as people. As my uncle used to say, when he moved out to the area where he practiced, his neighbors became his patients and his patients became his friends.
That would be, as they say, ideal. Anything else you'd like to share?
Well, I hope that this story attracts readers who are not necessarily grounded in medical practice. It has meaning for medical personnel, but it's written in a way that should be enjoyable to people without medical training. I think we all know how much people enjoy medical dramas on TV, and I hope that readers will find that the book works along those same lines. One of the reviewers actually said there's a lot of technical medical description, but it really just serves as scenery for the story about the characters.
It's your book, Training in Charity, published in January, ready for our read. Continue educating future Dr. Alan Saxons, and of course, tell us how we find out more information about reading your novel, please.
Well, the book is available on Amazon, and it is being distributed through a distributor that makes it available, so it can really be ordered from any bookstore. When Amazon first listed it, I think the title was misleading because I found it in a queue with training manuals for nonprofits, but it's actually medical fiction. And if you just put my name into Amazon, it'll come up.
Right. Again, that name, Alensaxon. Continued good work to you, and look back at the great work you have done. Your book is out, Training in Charity. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's a simple name of the book, Antique. Let's talk to author. 3, 2, 1. Seth Panage on the line, playwright, screenwriter, filmmaker, and author of Antique. Well, you know where we're going with this. Hope you're an Antiques Roadshow fan because you're going to love this work. It's described as an uplifting magical story about a once-celebrated antique appraiser who gets caught in the thrall of a strange, powerful necklace. I'm going to let you talk more. Seth, I'm glad you're here.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's good work that you are doing, giving back to your students at the University of Alabama. Of course, yes, as we mentioned, behind the scenes as screenwriter, filmmaker, and of course, now author with the title, with the word antique. It's as simple as that. Yes, Seth?
Yeah, it's as simple as that, I guess, and as complicated as that, right? What do we consider antique in this world? And it does have two meanings, right? It's something that's of value or it's something that's washed up. And I think that society sometimes calls things washed up when they really have magic left in them, and that's what the book's about.
Yes. Is there a mention of an antiques roadshow throughout?
Oh, yes. Our hero, Gray Schaefer, used to be one of the main appraisers on Antiques Roadshow, and she left her job. Her husband is the host of Antiques Roadshow, and she adores him. Unfortunately, he adores his assistant. They have an affair, and so Grace is forced off the show. But she does find a way to get back to the show through this magical object that she comes into contact with.
Yeah. Seth, would you expand into, obviously, your storyline?
Sure, of course. So as I said, Grace is one of our main appraisers on Antiques Roadshow. She's humiliated on the show. She leaves the show. She finds herself galloping a pace towards 50 without her husband, who she adored, without her job, without her father, who was like her guiding North Star professionally. And she's finally at the place professionally she could speak to him as an equal. And she's left with a mother that confounds her, as mothers sometimes do for us. And she finds herself at one of these minor league antiques roadshows in the middle of nowhere. And she looks at the objects and the people very differently now. And she starts overvaluing things a little bit here and there, a dollar here, a dollar there, because she feels it should be worth more because it's worth more to these people. And it's this one necklace, this old tarnished necklace she comes into contact with, and she can't stand it. She way overvalues it by thousands of dollars, and she ends up buying it to cover her tracks so she didn't get fired. But what she finds is that when she's wearing this necklace and she overvalues something, when people take it to auction, it sells for exactly that amount of money. And so that puts her back in the middle of the art world and on the track of her holy grail. Every appraiser has this one thing they've been looking for that's been lost to time that they think can cap their career and even cap their lives. But ultimately for Grace, the question is she looking in the wrong direction? Should she be looking within? And that's what the piece is about, how we value ourselves or misvalue ourselves and the magic and old forgotten things, even us as we age.
Since the themes included in this read, does antique take us on an exhilarating journey of art and love is involved here, yes?
Yes, it is. I mean, it's Grace's love of history, of these objects, and ultimately, you know, the love story is between Grace and herself. Although she's also rediscovering her father, even though he's passed, she's appraising him and her relationship with him, and she's appraising her mother as well throughout as she appraises herself. And even she gets an opportunity to appraise her ex-husband and see what was behind what he's done. So she gets a different, you know, sort of vision in it. But she does go to all of these antique shows. She gets to go to back to Antiques Roadshow, and we get a great vision behind the scenes there. I spent a long time researching that. And then she's on the hunt for this this lost art object, and it takes her, you know, off to Sotheby's and off to England and all the way back into history to find out who created this great piece of art that she's found.
Author of Antique, Seth Panich on the line. I was going to ask you about your research. Obviously, you must be either a fan or had to research, of course, Antiques Roadshow, as seen here on WGVU-TV. But did you also, have necklaces been in your world? What other research did you have to do, Seth?
I don't know if necklaces have been in my world, but a lot of books on necklaces have been on my world. I bought about 20 books on appraising and Antiques Roadshow, the British version and the American version, and really immersed myself in it. Thank God, the internet's good for one or two things, and it is good for research. So tons of YouTubes on appraising, and on Sotheby's, the auctions, the drama of those auctions, for me as a theater person, are just unbelievable. The way that an appraiser, a great appraiser, is able to make people pay more than they think they can. That command of the room, and that's the climactic scene takes place at an auction at Sotheby's. With that type of an appraiser. But I've always been obsessed with history and, yes, with Antiques Roadshow. In fact, I got the idea for the book watching Antiques Roadshow. There was an older gentleman. He brought in this old rug that was just thrown over a chair in his house, and it ended up being worth $500,000. It was a Navajo rug, and he just started crying, talking about his grandmother and his grandfather. They were just poor farmers, and what he was really crying about is that he thought the world was telling him that his grandparents were worth $500,000, not that it was the rug. And so, yeah, I've always been obsessed with Antiques Roadshow.
And I always like to ask this of males riding with a female lead. Any unique, why Grace is not Gary?
That's a great question. It always came to me as Grace. I think I saw that world very similar to my mother's side of the family in New York, in New Jersey. And in fact, my mother's mother passed before I was born, and so did my mother's father. And so he's Albert in a lot of ways in the play, Grace's father. And Grace's mother, in many ways, is my mother's mother, because I never got to meet them. They were always these sort of titanic, historical, mythological figures to me. And Grace herself is a compilation of a lot of the women on my mother's side of the family. And so, but also Grace is the feminine side of me. And I think that writers... writers don't write sex, they write character, unless the piece, of course, is very much about that person's identity, which this is not. This is about this person's spiritual identity and how she looks at herself, and I think that that's a universal thing. But Grace is the feminine side of me.
And lastly, do you bring your work into your classroom?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I do teach graduate playwriting and screenwriting, and that has definitely improved my ability to teach long form in that class, and I think that's professors have to do this, right? They have to go out into the world and get their fanny slapped by the challenge, so they come in and teach their students. But I will also add to that it's the enthusiasm that my students bring into class that then fuels me as a writer. And when I see them really put themselves on the line, it reminds me that I have to keep doing that as well. So it does work both ways.
All right. Antique, out where all fine books are sold. Tell us more how to find out about you and your work, Seth.
Well, they can go online. I have a website, sethpanich.com. I always like people to contact me through my email, sethpanich@gmail.com, when they buy the book and let me know what they connect with. It can be found at all great bookstores, because, if they have my book, they must be great. And Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
All right. Keep up your good work. Hello to those budding future actors. And keep up, of course, you as a playwright, screenwriter, filmmaker, Seth Panich. Antique, your work. Take care.
Thank you.
West Facade is written by my next guest, Lauren C. Johnson, on the line, bringing us to Paris, the dawn of the bubonic plague, statues that guard the Notre Dame Cathedral, forbidden from experiencing human pleasures, .. Let's get into this conversation we are to have about your latest novel and, why the name. Good that you're here. Good morning to you, Lauren.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You are quite welcome. A novel about a cathedral statue that discovers what it means to be human, then faces an impossible choice. That's called a cliffhanger. Tell me more about you, Lauren, and your work in the writing world. No stranger to you with your BS in journalism.
Absolutely. About my work as a writer, I can, you mentioned the journalism degree. I earned my journalism degree from Emerson College, and always knew that I loved writing in all forms, either journalism or fiction or creative nonfiction, and have always explored all different types of writing. So I went on to earn my MFA in creative writing, and really, I would say it was in my late 20s that I really wanted to take myself seriously as an aspiring fiction author. I believe that that wasn't, when I was younger, I believed that that wasn't a practical pursuit, that I should focus on types of writing that would earn more stability. And journalism has also faced so many challenges just in this technological and economic landscape. And I've also, moving on into my career, have also taken work in content marketing. So I've really been all over the place in terms of writing.
Nice. Well, but, let's get into what you're presenting with us now. It's about a statue. Tell me a little bit about your storyline.
Yeah, so absolutely. So it takes place at the start of the bubonic plague, and it's a statue of Saint Genevieve, who is a statue on the west facade of the Notre Dame Cathedral. And if you visit Notre Dame, when you approach there's three entrances, and if you approach the cathedral from those three entrances, you'll see these statues in the doorways and over in the arches. And some of those are statues of saints and angels and cherubs. And then high up in the balconies are the gargoyles. And I just, when the first time I saw the cathedral, I was so struck by how expressive they were and what types of stories might be behind if they were to come alive, what would they be thinking? What would be in their inner worlds after just watching people for so long? And so I had to, going back to your question about writing, I just had to pursue this story. I was so curious. It just was an idea that never left me. And I started to take it seriously, and I wanted to write into it. And I had it take place during the bubonic plague, because part of the story is these statues come to life at night when it's completely dark, and taking place during the new moon. And I had to pick a time in history where the cathedral would have been complete, but also it would have been dark enough where my readers would have been able to suspend their disbelief enough to buy into the premise. So the time that I ended up settling on was mid-1300s. And then at that point, I realized, well, that was the bubonic plague. Yeah. And what other stakes would that event would raise the stakes? If a statue is having to decide between being mortal or being a statue, that would absolutely raise the stakes of, if you're mortal and you're facing the threat of a pandemic, then...
Didn't you write this in the pandemic of our own world?
Part of it. I'd started it long before that. It began as a story, and I tried to make it into, well, first it was a short story, and I brought it into my MFA class and kind of workshopped it over time. It grew into a novel, and I had a rough draft, but I really was revising it during COVID-19. And especially in the second half of the book, as I was writing that, I was processing a lot of my own anxieties about COVID. Living in San Francisco, where I live, and living in a densely populated neighborhood and a densely populated apartment building, and challenging and just channeling my anxieties into my book as I was revising. And it provided, I definitely would say it provided an outlet, and it provided a way for me to empathize as well as what people were going through during the bubonic plague.
And of course, just fun to write about a cathedral statue, West Facade, written by my guest, Lauren Johnson. Lauren, tell me more about this cathedral statue that discovers what it means to be human. How's that theme?
Absolutely. So as humans, well, first, Genevieve is standing on the cathedral watching other people live. And as a statue, she, you know, they believe that they're all safe from anything that could threaten our relatively short human lives. But also at the same time, you get to watch other people have these experiences, eating food, falling in love, getting into fights with people, just all the things, that all the dramas that make up our lives, and watching that and not getting to experience it. And so when she gets this opportunity to climb down the cathedral wall and walk amongst people and also just exercise her own sense of agency, then she really, I think, she realizes that just isn't worth it to think that you could last forever and be safe on a cathedral wall, but not really get to fully live. And even if there are risks, and even if the mortal lives are relatively short, it's worth it to have those experiences.
Cool. All right, Lauren Johnson, continued good work that you do. Love the front cover of the West Facade, and tell us how we find out more information and how to get your book.
Absolutely. I'm at laurencjohnson.com, and you can get my book wherever you like to buy books. And if it's not available, just you can order, you can click back order, or also you can go to Santa Fe Writers Project and that website and order directly from there.
All right. Keep on doing what you do, and we'll keep on our read. Lauren Johnson, again, your work is out, The West Facade. Take care.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month, which every month should be, but let's put a special emphasis on this wonderful month of May. So we bring in my next guest. The St. Clair Butterfly Foundation partners across education, justice, behavioral health, community, and workforce systems to strengthen capacity from within. When systems stabilize, people don't just cope better, they function better. So on behalf of, well, the word St. Clair, let's bring on the St. Clairs, Chip and Lisa St. Clair, to discuss this, a book, and obviously how best to be aware this month. Good morning to you, Lisa St. Clair.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Good morning to you, Chip St. Clair.
Good morning. We really appreciate being here.
Yes, Chip, I'll stay with you. Tell me about the St. Clairs.
Well, we've been married for 34 years, or together 34 years, married for 27, high school sweethearts, and, you know, went through lots of childhood trauma. I did growing up, ultimately finding out a dark secret about my father, my family, and so we dedicated our lives since then to making this world a better place.
Your side of the story, Lisa.
So, yeah, Chip and I, what we found in common, the arts, really, really created that bond for one another. And then what helped me to stay there was Chip's authenticity and his willingness to be open about what he had experienced in childhood. My home was my safe place, so I didn't know this kind of world, but really... It was Chip's courage to kind of pull back the veil and reveal to me what had been going on.
Yes, and of course the book, The Butterfly Garden, we'll get to in a minute. Let me have one of you, because you can point to each other, standing or sitting next to each other most likely, as May is Mental Health Awareness Month. How is the St. Clair Butterfly Foundation involved, and what is your premise here?
Yeah, you know, mental health is not only an individual issue. The way we see it through St. Clair Butterfly Foundation is it is a systems issue. When environments increase perceived threat, No amount of personal resilience will produce regulation, decision-making, or learning. So what we have to do is change the environment, what the environment's asking of the nervous system. So, for instance, let's say a teacher, a teacher reached out to us last spring. She has a, had a fourth grader who shut down every time math started. The school had been writing him up for noncompliance, and we changed one thing with our professional development and our programming. We showed the teacher that if she just took 90 seconds at the start of class to regulate her own nervous system before walking in, what happened is within 3 weeks, all those shutdowns of that student had stopped. The child had not changed at that point. The adult had, and helped him regulate his nervous system.
Lisa, you please.
Yeah, so it's really a testament to helping empower educators to be able to use these tools in real time to be able to regulate their breath, to identify their emotions properly, and to be able to apply that and help their students. So trauma-informed care recognizes trauma, and we kind of took that a step further to elevating it to beyond trauma-informed, where we stabilize the adult nervous systems first. We reduce systemic threat. We eliminate shame-based correction. We distinguish distress from performance. And we redesign environments so that regulation is built in, not bolted on.
Remind me then about how the foundation works, the St. Clair Butterfly Foundation. I'm listening. What does one receive from this, and how do I get involved?
Yeah, so, you know, what we have is basically a neuroscience-based operating system. We use our what we call our butterfly labyrinth to mirror how the nervous system actually moves from survival state into executive function. And so we work with four ecosystems: education, justice, including law enforcement, juvenile justice, prosecuting attorney's offices, behavioral health and healthcare, and then community. And within those ecosystems, for example, we recently trained a local sheriff's department, showing them that when they arrive on the scene of any call, they're automatically influencing that environment. And so if they can remain regulated, they help to regulate the environment itself and have more productive outcomes.
Again, May, Mental Health Awareness Month. St. Clair Butterfly Foundation assisting with this, with Chip and Lisa St. Clair, your proprietors. Chip, would you talk a little bit more about the Butterfly Garden?
Yeah, so the Butterfly Garden, our memoir, really chronicles my childhood growing up facing a lot of distress, a lot of adversity and abuse. My father threw me out of a rowboat when I was 8 years old into Lake Michigan, rowed away, left me there. And all I had in my mind was a poem I had recently read called Invictus, which means unconquerable in Latin. And, you know, over time, I really fostered that love for literature and the arts, and that became my safe place. Met Lisa in high school, and, you know, she was this amazing rock, this person who really gave me courage and strength. And 6 years after dating in 1998, when I was 22 and Lisa just turned 22, we found out my father was one of America's most wanted fugitives. He had dislocated my shoulder, was arrested by the police after Lisa called them. And so I found out my entire life was a lie.
Lisa, your thoughts?
You know, as a teenager, I was not prepared for this understanding and really going through this revelation. It was very eye-opening for me. Fortunately, I had my solid foundation growing up. But what I really realized is I needed to be open-minded and I needed to be regulated to be able to process all of this and to be able to help Chip to process it. You know, I was fortunate in my home that emotions were safe and that I could go to my parents. And people called me courageous for calling the police that evening. And I didn't even have to think twice. It was just, it was second nature for me. It was intuitive. That's only because I was not desensitized by trauma within my home. So what we've learned so much over the years and really immersing ourselves into these spaces is that behavior is a signal. It is not a problem. It's an opportunity for us to be able to connect with others and really find ways to communicate more effectively.
How are we doing, Chip, when it comes to discussing and being aware of mental health these days?
You know, we're definitely getting better. Mental health is not such a stigma. You know, you hear more and more people talking about being able to, to go to therapy or to, you know, when they feel overwhelmed or stressed. But I still think we could do a better job defining really the boundaries of mental health. I think we often think of it as only therapy, when that's definitely an important component of it. But mental health is something just like physical health, we have to take sort of an assessment of every day. If we had a pain in our arm or our foot when we get up in the morning, or, you know, something wasn't feeling right, we, you know, might go to a doctor to have it checked out, or we might try to remedy it ourselves. When it comes to mental health, you know, stress is often the underlying factor, and it's an accumulation of stress that ends up activating, or chronic stress activating our fight, flight, freeze, or fawn mode, and that typically drives behavior. So if we can lower that baseline stress level daily by doing deep breathing techniques, by visualization, by our emotional awareness, by just being able to get out of our amygdala, our reptilian brain, into our prefrontal cortex, that's where we think and make good decisions. We can reinforce more positive things in our lives and become the best versions of ourselves.
Lisa, what else would you like to share with our audience as we say our goodbyes?
Sure. So what we've come to realize is that people are not failing systems. Systems are reacting too late. So, you know, people are doing exactly what their nervous systems are designed to do. Most systems are responding after activation instead of before it. And that is the gap we close.
Okay. But keep open, the St. Clair Butterfly Foundation. Lisa and Chip St. Clair, how do we find out more information about your work, the book, and more?
Yeah, to find out more information about St. Clair Butterfly Foundation, listeners can visit stclairbutterflyfoundation.org or scbf.org to learn more.
All right, all. Take care and keep on doing what you do so well to raise awareness about mental health. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, you're ready to learn the secret? How about getting even deeper the secret history of French cooking? New York Times bestselling author Luc Barr does take us inside the culinary rebellion that upended the staid French food world, the creation of, well, a unique cuisine movement, and more. I'll let you take it from here. Of course, I'll ask why your interest. Let's get right to it. Luc, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thank you for you. Interested in the way that the French eat?
I love French food. I have to admit, I've been traveling to France basically my whole life on vacation, and then also writing books, researching previous books, and I do love it.
All right. What is, before I get into obviously the secret history of French cooking, how would you define what French cooking even is?
You know, it's interesting. I you know, if you think back to the 1950s and 60s, this is before my time, but what was a great restaurant in 1962, let's just say, in New York City or in Chicago or anywhere? It was a French restaurant. It was always a French restaurant that was the ultimate great restaurant. So French food carries this weight of being the inventor. It's the invention of haute cuisine, going all the way back to Escoffier in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And those recipes that had been cooked for decades, you know, the duck à l'orange and all of the classics of French haute cuisine,
yeah,
they stayed the same for a long, long time. And it was just, this is what the secret history of French cooking, my new book, is about. The moment that this new generation of chefs in the late 60s, early 70s decided, you know what, I'm going to do something different. I don't have to just make the same duck à l'orange again. I don't have to just redo the same food out of the Escoffier handbook. I can try to invent a new dish, a new flavor, a new combination, a new idea. So that's the core story of this new book.
Why the secret history? Why use secret in your title?
You know, as I started my research, I was researching Paul Bocuse and the Trois Gras brothers and Michel Gérard. These are these wonderful chefs. I discovered a group of women chefs, Simone Lemaire, Annie Devine, a number of other chefs who, at the very same time that these young Turk avant-garde chefs of the Nouvelle Cuisine movement in the 70s were coming to the fore, there was a group of women chefs who were also running their own restaurants, and they were overlooked by the mainstream press, they were not allowed to join the Association of French Chefs, for example. And so they started their own organization. And that story had never been told. So that's one reason I thought, oh, it's a history that has never been told. And then the other thing is I discovered a wonderful villain in my research, the all-powerful food critic for Le Monde, who has a role in the story, an interesting role, and his history, likewise, has never truly been told because he had a very dark past, and that is, you know, I uncovered the full story of that in the research of this book.
Very cool. Again, a James Beard Foundation Book Award nominee, you, Luke Barr, of course, sharing this story, larger-than-life characters. Let's zone into one of your women characters.
You know, there's the Annie Devine, for example. During my research, I had a wonderful time, as you can imagine, researching this book, traveling all over France, visiting these restaurants. And it was a cold November, rainy day. I took a train from Paris up to Vervins in the north near the Belgian border in the small town where this woman, Annie Devine, had been running her restaurant since the 70s. And she was the one who initiated the creation of the ARC, this organization of women chefs. And she is still cooking today, in her 80s. I went there for lunch. I interviewed her, heard her stories about how she had applied. She sent a letter to the Maître Cuisinier, the official association of French chefs in France. This is in the early 70s. And asking to join. Her restaurant was well regarded. She had received a Michelin star, and the organization wrote her a letter back saying, no women allowed. And that's what led her to then reach out to other women chefs and newspaper writers and other people to launch this organization. And the fact that she is still going strong and eventually, decades later, was admitted into the association, is a wonderful part of this history.
Again, your book, The Secret History of French Cooking, don't forget the outlaw chefs who made food modern. Tell me a little bit more about this outlaw, angle, Luke, a tale of rivalries, global success, and a ferocious backlash of celebrity money and politics?
Yes, well, you know, the flag bearer for Nouvelle Cuisine was Paul Bocuse, and he was a sort of charismatic, dashing figure who was a womanizer. You know, he had a wife and he had a mistress, and he was this sort of larger-than-life character who also loved to say provocative things in the press, things like, I love women. I don't like women in the kitchen, though. They don't have any good ideas for cooking. They can't be great chefs. So he was sort of stirring up the controversy about whether women could be great chefs or not. Michel Girard was the sort of genius of the group. He was he's sort of a charming younger guy, very inventive, creating new dishes, experimenting with new techniques. The idea of cooking something sous vide, for example, that had never been done before until the Trois Gras brothers in Rouen in France started experimenting with ways to make foie gras. And so there were sort of technical innovations and recipe innovations, combining flavors, discovering ingredients from overseas, some spice from Thailand or a Chinese method of making dumplings or, all of this, which we take for granted today, that chefs are inspired by many different elements or flavors or their experiences or that they make it personal to themselves in some way. That was all new at the time for Nouvelle Cuisine, as was the presentation, the plate coming out dramatically from the kitchen to your table, the sort of oversized plate with this beautiful food on it. That was another sort of element that Nouvelle Cuisine invented. And then, of course, the backlash was just as you can imagine. I mean, if you remember anything about Nouvelle Cuisine today, what you remember is, it was a fad in the 70s with gigantic plates and tiny portions of food and little fussy pieces of kiwi fruit on top of a slice of chicken or whatever. That's the cliche. And the reality is the cliche actually did occur. What happened was that, Bocuse and Girard and these other chefs were incredibly successful. Bocuse was on the cover of Newsweek magazine, in 1976 or something like that. So many, many other restaurants started following suit and doing sort of imitation Nouvelle Cuisine. And that only led to bad results because, there's nothing, the people started realizing going to restaurants and being served sort of inedible, undercooked pieces of fish and overly sweet dishes with strange fruits, all the cliches of Nouvelle Cuisine sort of conspired to create an enormous backlash. And so soon enough, by the early 1980s, Nouvelle Cuisine is a thing of the past. But as I argue in this book, I think the origins of how we eat today really do go back to this kind of fascinating moment in the 1970s.
Just decades ago. If one is not aware of what a James Beard Foundation Book Award nominee is, what does that mean, Luke?
Well, there's an organization in New York called the James Beard Foundation, founded in honor of James Beard, the great chef, and also, by the way, a main character in my first book. I wrote a book called Provence 1970, which was about MFK Fisher, who was my great aunt, and James Beard and Julia Child all together on a sort of vacation in 1970. That was the topic of my first book. James Beard, after he died, his legacy was the creation of this foundation, which celebrates chefs and cooking and hands out awards. The main thing they do is give out awards to up-and-coming restaurants, but they also give out awards to books about food and cooking. And one of my earlier books, I believe it was Provence 1970, was nominated by the James Beard Foundation. So that's what that means.
Yes, and they can never take that away from an introduction. All right, lastly, if one wanted to start French cooking, what would you advise the recipe be?
Let's see. I think starting out with an omelet might be the way to go. We all make omelets, we all fry eggs, we make scrambled eggs. Devoting a little bit of attention to carefully making an omelet the way that, Paul Bocuse might have made the omelet, or Simone Lemaire for that matter, is very simple and worth figuring out. So that's my very simple recommendation.
I'm glad you have figured out the secret history of French cooking. There you are, best-selling author, James Beard Foundation Book Award nominee. That's you, Luke Barr. How do we find out more information about your work?
You can always go to my website, lukebarr.net.
With two R's. Luke, thank you very much for your research and conversation.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.